ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, a Commonwealth report warns Australians how climate change will affect us in the decades to come. Also, the ANZ Bank hit with a $240 million fine for misconduct. And Fred Brophy and his boxing troupe make their last appearance at the Birdsville races.
I'm 73 now. I can't do it like I used to. I've done my time out here. I've earned a good reputation. I love the people out here. I love all the locals. I love all the tourists.
The most comprehensive assessment of the risk climate change poses to Australia has been released today by the federal government. Prepared by the Commonwealth's Australian Climate Service, the report draws on figures and analysis from bodies including the Bureau of Meteorology, the CSIRO and Geoscience Australia. And it's warning we're going to be seeing more floods, cyclones, heatwaves, droughts and bushfires in the years ahead. The report comes just days before the federal government announces its emissions target for 2035. Isabel Masali reports.
It's still considered a cool time of year in WA's north, but the community of Jarrajin just had a very close call with fire, fuelled by strong winds. Some cars and infrastructure have been lost.
Everything's just parched. It's all just black. It's like a bomb went off. And it's really quite terrifying, especially for people who don't live with fire like that.
Nathan McIver is the CEO of the Aboriginal Corporation, and fire isn't his only concern in a warming climate. He fears the impact of heat on the community's 400 residents.
Insulation is key, obviously, but when you've got inferior materials that you use to build a house and or you don't use common sense approaches of the flow through of air, then that really causes a lot of problems when it comes to rheumatic heart disease and other related diseases in communities.
A landmark report shows the impacts of climate change in Australia's north, remote communities and the outer suburbs of cities are of particular concern, but everywhere will be affected.
Cascading, compounding, concurrent. That's how the Australian Climate Service describes the impact of climate change on every community in our country.
Climate Change Minister Chris Bowen.
Cascading. It will get worse over time. Compounding. Each impact of climate change will make another impact worse. And concurrent, communities will suffer the impacts of climate change in different ways at the same time.
It models the impacts across Australia under three scenarios of global warming. That's 1.5 degrees, 2 degrees and 3 degrees above pre-industrial temperatures.
And it's too late to avoid any impacts. But it's not too late to avoid the worst of the impacts. As the report makes clear, the difference in terms of impact between 1.5 and 2 degrees of warming, let alone 3, is very real for Australia. So hence, our efforts on mitigation must and will continue.
The assessment is the most comprehensive to date and is publicly available. But let's break down a couple of key areas with ANU Professor of Climate Science, Sarah Perkins Kirkpatrick. Along the coast, about 1.5 million people will be at risk from rising sea levels by 2050.
Basically saying that we should plan for sea level rise of up to 1 metre across Australia or across coastal Australia. And with that comes the susceptibility of risk of many of our coastal communities. And it's important to remember that a lot of Australians actually live on the coast. And with increasing sea level rise also comes increasing storm surge when we get bad storms and cyclones come through, as well as the infrastructure, the communities who live there, the housing that's there, all of these important parts of Australian lifestyle that we actually have on the coast.
The report also covers everything from the risk to infrastructure to the environment and food systems. On health, the warnings cover disease, air quality, mental health and heat.
The report is quite confronting with the projections it shows with heat-related mortality, particularly over some parts of the world as we approach 3 degrees global warming. So, for example, it says that in Darwin, if we do reach 3 degrees global warming, there'll be a 400% increase in the number of people that will die due to extreme heat alone. And Sydney's roughly at the same percentage, and Melbourne and Perth are at 300 to 350% percent change. So this means we're going to see a lot more people die of extreme heat.
Professor Perkins Kirkpatrick explains scientists have known this for some time, but says this report is important to boost public knowledge and help Australia put in place appropriate adaptation policies. The federal government has also released its adaptation plan today, and it'll soon commit to its emissions target for 2035.
Undoubtedly, the higher that target, the better. We need to do as much as we can as soon as we can.
Climate groups are also repeating that message today as they respond to the report, with the Climate Council describing the assessment as a horror story. CEO Amanda McKenzie.
So it's a very sobering picture when you read the report. Mm. But the really important thing is that the risks are not a given. It really depends on the level of action that is taken now by us here in Australia and around the world to slash our climate pollution from coal, oil and gas.
The federal government is expected to announce its 2035 climate target later this week.
That report from Isabel Masali and Dunya Karagic. The ANZ Bank has today been slammed by the financial regulator for betraying the trust of Australians and ripping off the federal government. The Australian Securities and Investments Commission, ASIC, is asking a court to hit the bank with a $240 million penalty, the largest fine it's ever levied. ASIC says the bank's widespread misconduct involved shonky bond trading for the government, as well as failures to pay correct interest rates, refund fees charged to dead people and help struggling customers. Julia Bergen reports.
The head of Australia's financial regulator made it clear today that ANZ's misconduct is a major concern.
Time and time again, ANZ has fallen short. Time and time again, ANZ has betrayed the trust of Australia.
Joe Longo is the chair of the Australian Securities and Investments Commission, or ASIC.
The issues we have found in the bank's different divisions are a mix of widespread misconduct, repeated failures, and an unacceptable disregard for the trust customers put in banks.
He says this is the 11th time in just over a decade that ANZ has been prosecuted by ASIC. This time, it's facing the biggest fine in the history of Australia's banking sector. The bank reached an agreement with ASIC to pay $240 million, covering four separate cases of misconduct committed over many years. One of those four breaches relates to work ANZ was doing for the federal government. ANZ was managing $14 billion worth of government bonds, an investment by the Commonwealth to help fund priorities like health and defence.
ASIC's position is that ANZ's misconduct potentially made the government $26 million worse off. That $26 million reflects that the bond futures price decreased by 2 basis points over the 45 minutes before pricing, when ANZ traded most actively in the market. The critical issue here is that ANZ sold a significant volume of 10-year Australian bond futures around the time of pricing, which placed undue downward price pressure on the bond price.
While that wording might make it seem unclear as to whether ANZ's conduct did indeed cost the government $26 million, Joe Longo made it clear where ASIC stands.
ASIC's position is the Commonwealth did suffer a loss of around $26 million.
ANZ has admitted its management of those public funds was indeed unconscionable conduct, but it's denied it caused any financial loss. The other three breaches relate to ANZ's treatment of its customers. One was the bank's failure to acknowledge customers' hardship applications. In those cases, despite requests for help, ANZ went ahead with debt collection activities. Another breach was that ASIC made false and misleading statements about some of its saving rates and then failed to pay those rates. And the dead were not spared from ANZ's misconduct either. It failed to refund fees to thousands of deceased customers. Joe Longo says the bank's actions impacted nearly 65,000 customers.
I've just been asked a moment ago, what word could I use to sort of make have resonance with ordinary Australians. Well, I think that's grubby.
ANZ has released a statement apologising to customers. Dr. Helen Bird from Swinburne University is an expert on corporate governance.
As the days unfolded, it's become larger than you could possibly imagine. It really does sound like they wrapped together a whole lot of issues that were affecting them that ASIC was investigating, drew a line in the sand and said, let's get rid of all of this, we've got a new CEO, we'll pay some money and be done with it.
So do you expect that this will be the end of the road in terms of ANZ making breaches in various different ways?
Well, practically speaking, my understanding is that the government has taken away its bond management work from the ANZ Bank. So there's no risk of that occurring again. They simply don't have the business anymore. But the other issues, well, they are issues that have affected all the banks and have been ongoing. And the only way to resolve them is to have proper risk management procedures and adequate staff. What I will say is the attempt to reduce the staff by 3,500 people, which was announced last week, kind of makes you worry because, you know, at the same time as we're needing to make sure you're investing properly in risk management, you're announcing that you're getting rid of a whole lot of staff.
Financial Counselling Australia welcomed news that ANZ would be hit with a massive fine. The organisation's co-CEO is Dr. Dominique Meyrick. She's particularly concerned about the people whose hardship applications were ignored by ANZ.
For those nearly 500 customers who were in vulnerable situations, who had experienced domestic and family violence or were very, very unwell and had reached out to their bank seeking support and a hardship arrangement, look, this message will probably vindicate their sense that the treatment that they received was unacceptable. But really the impacts of reaching out and getting either radio silence or a long delay, or in the worst cases, you know, debt recovery action taken against you, you know, that's pretty hard to make up for.
Dealing with the fallout of all this will be a task for ANZ's chief executive, Nuno Matos, who has only been in the role for a matter of months.
That report from Julia Bergen. Queensland teachers remain in an industrial dispute with the state government over their pay and conditions. They claim its offer of an 8% pay rise over 3 years would leave them the worst paid teachers in the country, and that the violent and disruptive behaviour of students is making their job even more difficult. Some schools, though, are trying to reset the classroom environment to benefit both teachers and students. Rachel Mealy filed this report.
The sounds of the schoolyard are the same, but the Y School in Brisbane's North Lakes is a little different. Many of these students have come here after being suspended from mainstream schools. Some have lashed out at teachers. Others carry trauma from turbulent home lives that spills over into anger, defiance, or simply shutting down. Stephanie Blunt is the head of wellbeing at Y Schools Queensland.
Traditionally, we've thought of it as good and bad behaviour, but if we actually think of behaviour as a language and think about what is going on for this young person, what are their unmet needs? They often have unmet developmental needs. They often have had difficult experiences. Sometimes they've felt unsafe or experienced bullying in mainstream school, which, you know, does create long-term toxic stress for them.
She says children come to the classroom every day with different needs.
We are an independent school and we're a special assistance school. So generally what that means is all of our young people have disengaged for whatever reason from mainstream. And for, you know, really a really wide variety of reasons, they've just found that mainstream hasn't been able to meet their needs or they haven't been able to fit into that environment.
The Y School doesn't look like other schools, and that's the point. Classrooms have low lighting and instead of rows of desks, soft chairs and low tables are scattered across the room. In other areas, there are table tennis tables, pool tables and a big lounge area where a number of students are leaning over a laptop with a youth worker.
You can see it's a really lovely informal area. We call spaces like this our watering hole. So the students can socialise informally and, you know, interact. So we're learning lots of social skills all the time with between, you know, adults and young people. It's where youth workers in particular are able to do some role modelling around social skills and social interactions. There's lots of management of issues that go on in this space, yeah.
But special assistance schools like the Y School can only address a small part of the problem. Across the country, teachers have been documenting their feelings of burnout and stress on social media and sometimes recording their decisions to leave the profession altogether.
I quit my job. I quit my teaching job. Yeah.
I was in tears yesterday, though, so I was not smiling. I was crying driving home from work because I felt so freaking defeated. Teaching is one hard gig. Yesterday my class just pushed me over the edge, and today really just confirmed that that school, that job isn't for me.
I'm going to be with you for the rest of the week and the rest of next week, and then you will be getting a new teacher.
Why?
I know.
But then where are you going?
I'm going to be stepping away from teaching for a little bit.
Dr. Lyra Lestrange is a senior lecturer in the School of Education at QUT. She's teaching teachers how to deal with the stress they'll encounter in the classroom.
So obviously we need to do something differently. It's getting out of hand. We can see that the recent industrial strike is accumulation of many, many experiences across the profession of this is not working. The current state of play is not working.
She says teaching teachers to identify and deal with trauma is a key part of the solution, but it's not the only solution.
An educator in a classroom or early childhood centre is not operating in isolation. We need to think about the system lens on this as well. Like, what support are they getting from their leadership? What policies and practices that are coming from that top-down level help an educator feel supported in their work?
Dr. Lestrange says longer-term solutions demand a rethink of resourcing for schools and embracing new ways of engaging with students.
Well, I think there's a lot of great work happening, and it's really inspiring to hear of schools, and there's a lot here in Queensland as well as across Australia that are embedding these practices around safety, emotional regulation, and building healthy, supportive relationships within their classrooms, and within whether it's led by the classroom teacher or whether it's led by this whole of school approach, and leadership are coming on board as well.
That's Dr. Lyra Lestrange from the School of Education at QUT. Rachel Mealy, the reporter. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Ahead, we'll head to Birdsville in the Queensland Outback, where Fred Brophy and his boxing troupe have taken to the ring for the last time. In South Asia, human rights campaigners are alarmed by the number of women being killed because of their prominence on social media. In Pakistan, at least 8 women have been murdered in the last year alone. Among them was 17-year-old TikToker Sana Yusuf. She was shot dead in her bedroom by an alleged stalker. And a warning, this report from our South Asia Bureau Chief Meghna Bali includes details you may find distressing.
17-year-old Sana Yusuf had only been on social media for a couple of years, but she'd already built an audience of more than 1 million followers. She posted playful dances, fit checks, and the brand promotions that were beginning to turn her popularity into an income.
I like your beauty, I like your fashion.
On June 2nd, she uploaded a clip of herself cutting a cake in front of pink and white balloons. It was her 17th birthday. Later that day, she was killed.
He went straight to the door, shot her and left.
That's Sana's dad, Saeed Yusuf Hassan.
A man cannot lose himself at that moment. Who would look after my family? I have to bear the pain, but only I know what my heart has gone through.
Police say the main suspect is a 22-year-old man named Umar Hayat, who knew Sana from social media and wanted to meet her. They allege he killed her after she declined his offers of friendship. Her murder sparked protests across Islamabad. These women are shouting, "My body, my choice." This is women's rights activist Dr. Farzana Bari.
Wherever they feel that the woman is making her own choices or trying to get out of their control, they will just use violence.
The Human Rights Commission of Pakistan says Sana is one of 8 women murdered in Pakistan in the first 6 months of this year, targeted for their social media use.
In a society which dominantly very patriarchal, you know, socially, culturally, politically, so how do you expect that the space which will be created, you know, online will be free of gender biases and the same threats and harassment which women feel on the street?
The killings echo the case of Kandil Baloch, Pakistan's first social media star. She was strangled by her brother in 2016 after her online persona was deemed a stain on family honour. Nearly a decade later, little has changed. And it's not just Pakistan. In neighbouring India, Punjabi influencer Kanchan Kumari was allegedly strangled this June, accused of promoting obscenity. Some creators say they now live in fear. Others, like Indian historian and influencer Ruchika Sharma, are defiant.
I get death threats on the daily. I have people DMing me with all kinds of misogynist abuse. So I think women should really not toe the line. In fact, they should become even more militant about this. That's my personal opinion. Because the whole point is to scare you. So I don't want to give them that.
Back in Islamabad, Sana's father says his daughter's death must not silence others.
Listening to your heart is everyone's right. Working is every woman's right. Why should her desire be murdered?
Their only wish now, that no other family suffers the same fate.
The ABC's South Asia Bureau Chief, Meghna Bali. And if you're in an abusive situation or you know someone who is, please call 1-800-RESPECT. That's 1-800-737-732. If it's an emergency, call 000. Well, this year's Birdsville Races saw the last appearance of one of its long-time fixtures. For more than 4 decades, showman Fred Brophy has been bringing his boxing troupe to the event and inviting locals to challenge a fighter in the ring. Mr. Brophy is the last promoter of a spectacle that began in Australia in the 19th century, but he won't make it to Birdsville again. Diana Damjanovic prepared this report.
This is going to be the first fight. This is where boxing started with.
It's a throwback to the old days, a boxing tent at a big festival in outback Australia, where punters can step in, put the gloves on, and have a go. This boxing tent at the Birdsville Races has a long tradition, and the man who's been running it for 40 years is Fred Brophy, who's travelled around the country putting on these events since the mid-1970s. It's part circus, part showdown, part spectacle. But now these boxing bells have tolled for the last time in Birdsville.
It gets hard, and I'm 73 now, and when I'm getting up on that ladder and that, I can't do it like I used to. And I've done my time out here, I've earned a good reputation. I love the people out here, I love all the locals, I love all the tourists.
Birdsville, on the edge of the Simpson Desert in far west Queensland, is extremely hard to get to. And Fred Brophy says, as much as he loves it, it's demanding work.
Well, I've been blown down, I've been rained down, I've been bogged down. And I tell people, if you don't like the rain, you don't like the dust, you don't like the flies, look, I've got a few around now, you don't like the wind, just don't come.
Fred Brophy's boxing tent was pitched across the road from the pub during the famous horse racing carnival. Inside, courageous members of the crowd put up their hands if they want to fight, and a bell clangs if they're chosen. 25-year-old Henry Butler, who lives in Birdsville, remembers how it felt as a kid to watch his town, with a population of 100, explode during the annual races.
Me and my cousin, Kevin, we was watching it. We used to sneak over and just listen to the drums, watch the drums, and then watch all the fighters pop up.
And by the time Henry and Kevin were 10, Mr. Brophy got them into the ring.
Fred, that's when he looked at us, reckons, oh, I reckon these two young fellas should get up and have a fight. And then he reckoned, yeah, oh, there's going to be a special one tonight. And so we hopped up, looking at everybody. Like, and then the crowd is just like, they're yelling at you, go, young fella, and just, yeah, get you more pumped.
And while it's unlikely Fred Brophy's tent will make a return to Birdsville, Fred will still come to the races to enjoy life as a spectator.
Come back. I want to come back and see what they're going to do here. And be able to relax and enjoy the music, enjoy the races, enjoy everything. It'll be a bit of history that won't be here, but the races will still go on.
He says his boxing tent will still travel to other places, but for now, it's goodbye to Birdsville.
That report from Diana Damjanovic and Hannah Walsh. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. The podcast of the full program is available on the ABC Listen app, and we'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. One of the great things about owning an EV right now is that you're not taxed for using the roads, but the government's looking to change that. Today, Giles Parkinson, founder and editor of Renew Economy and The Driven websites, and an EV owner himself, on what he says is a half-assed idea. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.